you're very welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Delighted to say we're back with you. I know our many, many loyal listeners who tune in week in, week out, wondering when is this podcast coming back on the air. The good news is that it is, and delighted to say we're going to try and keep it semi-consistent for the rest of the end of this season and straight into the start of next season. So hopefully, regularly, weekly rugby podcast coming your way. Delighted to say we have Wesley Liddy, a gouger from the streets of Limerick, of course, you'd be familiar by now, young Munster supporter. Is there anything nice about him? The answer is probably not, but look, we're stuck with him anyway. RTE rugby editor as well. We have Mick Lennon, who's got the unenviable task, and he volunteered for this, by the way, of explaining the new format for the Heineken Champions Cup for next season, which he's going to take us through in just a second. And of course, the man needs no introduction, Mr. Bernard Jackman as well. Gentlemen, how are we?
Good, great, good. Thank you.
Good, you.
You're looking very relaxed there, Birch.
Yeah, nearly end of the day, so happy, yeah. Couple of sales today, so all good.
Nice one, nice prop. Listen, first of all, before we get into the Champions Cup format, just your general thoughts about rugby behind closed doors now, Bert. You've been at the DVV Stadium over the last couple of weekends, and just generally how you feel the game is shaping up. Very strange, I imagine, without the crowds, but I mean, how did you find it personally?
Look, I think the players deserve massive credit. They came back in great shape, particularly the Irish teams. Behind closed doors is crap, but it's just, for me, it's a stepping stone towards getting fans there. So it's probably part of the rigmarole we need to go through. And I think from speaking to the players and coaches, they're happy to have an outlet again and to get playing games. But the reality is there's no revenue coming in. So, you know, no revenue coming in through lockdown into the game. And now the players are back playing, but there's still very little revenue coming in. So it's still scary times for, you know, for professional rugby, professional sport. The elements of that are interesting in being in the ground, you know, in a stadium like that with no crowd is obviously you can hear the chat on the field and the energy and the bit of back chat and a bit of, I suppose, goading that's going on. But it's not the same. I mean, it's a weird atmosphere.
The novelty of that is going to wear off pretty soon.
Oh, well, yeah, so it's worn off already. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you want to have, like, Irish derbies, you want to have people there, and it's not the same at all.
I'm looking ahead to November, you know, and what's to come. We know Japan now probably aren't going to travel. There's speculation Georgia might come in and join the bill there, which would make a lot of sense. But, I mean, the key factor that you just mentioned there is that there's no crowds coming in, there's no revenue being generated, and rugby is a sport that doesn't have buckets of cash and reserves. Certainly the RFU would be better placed than a lot of unions in managing this crisis, but even they are being stretched fairly thin at the moment. And you just wonder how long this can be sustained, Vernon, before they literally have to either let crowds in or shut the game down.
Yeah, I think that's the question mark, and I think that's why the players, the agreement the RFU and the players had was they'd have another look at it later on in the year. So some of the payment was a pay cut, some of the payment was a deferral. But that's on the basis that, you know, there's revenue streams start to come back into the game from an Irish point of view. Potentially the Premiership and the top 14 have larger TV rights contracts, so the deficit isn't as great. But I think from what I understand of the Pro 14 model, a lot of clubs are more reliant on fans, corporate hospitality, sponsorship than they are on the TV money. So certainly for the Celtic Nations, I think it's even more important that we start to see people come back. And I know there's a health reason, such, but it's just, you know, how long that's going to take to get. And looking, I think Quinns have got 4,000 people
in this.
Claremont are having 5,000. How many in Claremont?
1,000, I think, this weekend was what I read this morning.
Yeah, so, you know, from other countries are starting to open up slightly in terms of sporting events. So hopefully, even if they were able to get 6,000 into the Viva to start, for example, you know, I'm sure that could be done. I know that there was proposals put forward that could be done in a safe manner. It'd be something coming in, you know, because the costs are still the same. And, you know, another 5-6 months of no revenue is going to put a massive dent in the RFU's cash reserves, which luckily they have, but there's a lot goes out every month as well.
England are trying to get 20,000 in for their game against the Babas on the 25th of October.
Okay,
that's all depending as well, but that's what they're looking at the moment.
It does seem like England are gonna push the boundaries in terms of sporting events and crowds coming in, and it's almost like Ireland are going to wait and see how they get on, Mick, before we respond to that. It does seem like they're going to lead the way, and we'll take a look. Racing as well. They're the St. Ledger meeting in Doncaster next weekend. They've got, I think, 4,000, 5,000 a day coming in through the gates there. So we'll have to see how
I wouldn't be using England and their horse racing crowd protocols as any kind of guide for how we should be handling the pandemic now, listen, to be honest.
I'm not recommending we follow the whole herd immunity system that England's here to do.
But Cheltenham's really gone out of your memory quickly, hasn't it?
It really does. Yeah, but it does seem like they're going to be the ones pushing the boundaries a bit, and then the test case, if you like, and then we'll have to respond in kind, I think, and see, depending on how they get on. But interesting. From a TV perspective, Wes, what did you make? I watched the game at the last weekend down at my local club, so I probably didn't get a sense of what it was like watching at home. How did you find the kind of crowd noises, the effects, if you like, and then just watching without the crowds? Was it very different?
I thought they did a good job, and I've been looking at this lately for kind of with our own work, obviously, across rugby and GAA, whether we'd use them or not. They obviously have basically kind of 6 or 7 stock tracks of, you know, general play, threatening to score, etc. You do get times like if something unanticipated happens in a certain part of the field. Like, for example, when Johnny Sexton put Ryan Baird away against Munster, that was a line break, possibly from a part of the field you wouldn't have expected it to happen. And they can't adjust quick enough for the sound to match what it would maybe sound like with a crowd there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's just the way it is. I think generally they've actually done a pretty good job around the rugby. I certainly found it much less disconcerting on the rugby so far, on the Pro 14 so far, than I did on the Premiership soccer, which that was just, whether it was because the atmosphere is so big there usually, or whether it was because it was the first thing back, that just seemed completely devoid of atmosphere. I think the rugby's been, they've handled it a little bit better, but I actually, come back to what Bert said, I mean, the IRFU probably wouldn't want us hearing it for fear of what we'd hear, but I'd love if there was a red button option to hear the natural atmos from the stadium and hear all that sledging and everything else that's going on between players. If you could flick over between the imagined effects and the actual live sound, to me, that'd be a great... I think there's actually an onus on sporting bodies when fans aren't there to maybe bring fans a little closer to the action in terms of whether that be cameras in a dressing room, cameras on a bus going to the ground, access to the Atmos. I think all this is, if you're to find the silver lining in all this, there are actually opportunities for things you can look at that you wouldn't have had open minds to during regular times.
Yeah, it must be really weird for the players as well, Bert. I mean, like, you know, running out into a stadium in an inter-pro derby against Munster, like this Friday night for Leinster, It still must take an awful lot of getting used to without any of the crowd there, without any of the noises, and the natural energy that the players will feed off from that. That's going to take a while to get used to. I know when I used to play for Greystone J3s, and when there was 30 out for Armagh there, geez, you get some buzz going out into Dr. Hickey Park. It's just not the same without the crowds, right?
No, it's not. And what you've seen is a lot of the teams trying to create that energy, so they're over-hyping up a positive bit of play. It's kind of like the Saracens model where they over celebrate in the benches. I mean, I was touchline for Munster Leinster. I mean, Craig Casey, you know, he roared and screamed like a fan for 80 minutes. And he was brilliant because he was living every moment. Then he got on and played 20 minutes and did really well. But so that's probably what you're getting there is the players trying to create an energy on the field or an energy amongst themselves that they generally feed off the crowd. But it is great. And I think, I think a lot of fans would like to hear, the to and fro from players. I mean, James Lowe, like against Munster, never shut up. I mean, he was just roaring and screaming at his own players as well. But, you know, he was giving Munster players plenty, and there was loads of back chat. And often you don't hear that, but we could hear it last week, and we probably hear it again Friday night.
All right. I think we should get into the game itself, though, before we come back, as I said, to the new Heineken Champions Cup format for next season. So, Mick, just your general thoughts to kick us off on the match, the Munster-Leinster, or the Leinster-Ulster game, I should say, from the weekend just gone. I mean, it was the Leinster second-string side, but they still look very, very accomplished out there. And it just highlighted, once again, if it needed highlighting, which it didn't, just how much strength and depth they have at the moment.
Yeah, I think they made 15 changes, so it was a completely new team against an Ulster team that kind of had a little bit to prove after the Connacht match, and I don't really reckon they proved much. I know they had a few changes as well. Mm. For some reason in the back of my head, I think actually Ulster might do okay on Saturday against Edinburgh, because I think they're really kind of backs against the wall, and it's their last springboard chance for their Champions Cup match, which is a huge match away in Toulouse. But it's, if ever a team needed a big performance, it's this Saturday for Ulster.
Yeah. What did you make of John Clooney's performance, Wes? A lot of talking points. You know, the try, obviously, the disallowed. A couple of decisions that he made that were a little bit strange. A couple of unforced errors. Like, this guy's been talked about as potentially a replacement for Conor Murray, when I actually think the replacement for Conor Murray for Ireland is actually at Munster, but we'll come back to that. But John Clooney's performance, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely wasn't his... probably the best game we've seen him have over the last while. I mean, to be honest, probably for me, the most eye-catching part with Ulster in terms of personnel has been just seeing Stockdale at 15 and how that's working out. And I was listening to Brian O'Driscoll talking about it the other night, and, you know, he's definitely... he's just so potent going forward. And you're kind of looking at a situation of him and Larmer now, who are both these incredible attacking players in different ways, and both possibly have some flaws to the defensive side of their game. With Stockdale, his flaws might actually be camouflaged by moving to 15 in a strange way, in terms of some of the bad positional stuff we saw from him on the wing at times. So I suppose when James Lowe's going to come into the Ireland equation as well, and Andrew Conway and Keith Earls have kind of somewhat picked up where they left off in terms of form, just like looking at these prospective internationals in November, there's it's very interesting to know how they're going to handle that whole back three selection and how much rotation's going to go on. I think Conor Murray's actually played all right. I mean, I know Craig Casey made a big impact when he came in, and that's a nice option for Munster to have, that they've someone to go to that will lift the tempo like that.
He's a right good player, Casey. Like,
but I don't think Cooney's in line to be first choice for Ireland.
No,
I didn't last year, and I don't know, to be honest about it.
Yeah, just okay. Well, the fullback question, Birch. You know, Andrew Conway is the form fullback in Ireland at the moment, is he not?
Well, he had not in the last 2 weeks.
No.
Well, he hasn't played. He hasn't played fullback.
Well, sorry, in terms of a back... Andrew Conway, over the last kind of... when he's got his chance at 15...
Yeah.
For me...
Conway's a very good fullback, for sure, but... yeah, he'd have to play there. I'd like to see him play there all the time for Munster.
Stockdale an option?
Stockdale was much better. It was good last weekend. He was good. He's got a great kicking game. And I think that's going to be huge. Having a left-footed fullback... is a lovely string to any team's attacking mindset and attacking weapons. And I think that's, if you look at Ireland last year, we kicked a hell of a lot off 9 and 10, and obviously Stockdale kicked a little bit on the wing, but as a 15 he has an option to split the field. So I think that's a big positive for him. I think the problem with Stockdale isn't that he doesn't know his positioning. I think he just switches off a lot and concentration. And I think I agree with Wesley, at 15, he has to be more on the ball, and potentially that gets more out of him. So I think that this could be a change. I think he needed something to rebuild his confidence.
It's like it keeps him involved, Birch, the freedom at 15. It keeps him tuned in because he's getting more touches or something, maybe.
Yeah, 100%. No, and his role in the back... his role in the backfield is, if he's late or he's not on the ball, there's going to be space somewhere. So he's constantly moving. I think he's a different threat running the ball back than Larmer. Larmer's got obviously better feet. And we've only been used to seeing Stockdale kind of straight line, straight line speed, and obviously that little chip and chase, which he's world class at. But I think it will test him to become better, and we'll see more evasion from him. I think hopefully it's an experiment. I think it's an experiment that is down to Addison being injured at the moment, is a key factor. Plus, potentially Andy Farrell having asked Dan McFarland to give him some game time there, and obviously trying to nurse him back into a little bit of confidence. But certainly under the high ball, he answered any questions that were put to him last weekend. Having said that, Leinster kicked a lot longer than Ulster do or Munster do. So, you know, he wasn't tested, you know, that much. And I'd like to see more of that and more bravery or more opportunities to show how brave he is under the high ball from contestables that are on the money, which Leinster's strategy was more kick it long, even off nine. So he wasn't tested yet, but definitely something to someone to watch over the next while and see, does he continue to develop?
I thought just on the Conway issue, I know this is me beating the drum here a bit, but in the first game against Leinster, I thought he was brilliant under the high ball and, you know, caught a couple over arms. I can't understand why he doesn't get more chances at 15.
He looks absolutely huge since he came back as well.
What?
He looks absolutely huge since he came back, his upper body. He looks like he's put on a good few kilos over the course of the lockdown.
Yeah. But what is it? There must be something that's missing that they're seeing on the training ground where they don't...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they're... I don't know. Potentially kicking game. You know, he doesn't have a massive boot, but either does Jordan. I like Andrew Conway. I think he is... unbelievably consistent. He's a finisher. He's aggressive. He works hard. I agree with you. He's very good on the high ball. He's played fullback for Ireland, from what I remember, in kind of some of the smaller games, and done very well against maybe tier two countries more so than tier one countries. But I would have absolutely no worry about Andrew Conway playing fullback for Ireland. But I haven't seen enough evidence that. You know, others are Munster. I think he's going to be on a wing for Munster most of the time. With Gallagher and Daly there seeming to be ahead of maybe a fullback. So I just don't know if he's going to get a huge amount of games. But is he a live contender as a winger? Yeah, I would say he is.
Okay. How did we rate Madigan's performance? Obviously, back in an Ulster jersey. I say back, he didn't play there before, but he's back in Ireland, is what I mean by that. How did you rate him, Birch, first of all?
Look, I think the problem for Cooney and Madigan is they're playing behind a pack who are really poor the last 2 weeks. Yeah. And that is going to affect halfbacks. And people spoke about Murray and Sexton. You know, for sure, maybe they weren't as on form as they have been in the past. But Ireland's forward pack were pretty average in the World Cup and the Six Nations games that we saw. And, you know, I thought Connor and Johnny for Leinster and Munster were better than they were for Ireland, and I think that you have to look into the performance of their pack. I mean, bar Marcel Coetzee, there's hardly anyone that Ulster pack that are really on form at the moment. And some of their line-out delivery is sloppy. Their ruck ball is poor because they're getting back knocked back. So
Henderson, I think it's probably, out. Henderson out.
Henderson's out, yeah. And I think until Ulster start showing a bit of form, particularly up front, and start getting over the gain line a little bit more, I'd hold judgment on Madigan. It's hard for Madigan. He hasn't started a game in 18 months. I think it's Dan was giving him game time because he sees him as someone to come on for a while. I would say, come on near the end, I would say Burns is ahead of him at the moment. And I don't see Madigan force his way back into the Irish picture.
Okay.
But I think he'd be an unbelievably good recruit for Ulster because with Matchison now, you know, they've got four really good halfbacks.
Okay, let's focus on this weekend then. Whereas if Munster are going to get a result on Friday night, I mean, I'm looking through the probable starting Munster backline. So Murray, Hanrahan, Earls and Conway on the wings, D'Alende and Chris Farrell in the centre, and probably Shane Daly at full back. Maybe you might swap one or two of those, which would stand up to any Leinster backline. The key is going to be up front. Munster pack perform to give those backs a platform. They have a good chance. If they don't, Leinster right over.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, for the last year, there's been a lot of talk. I suppose the pattern of the semi-final defeats in Europe, particularly that Munster have had, has been that they haven't kind of been able to bludgeon their way past the Sarries or the Racings or the very best sides. And I suppose the thinking with Stephen Larkin coming in was that, you know, their game would expand and evolve. And, you know, when they signed those two South Africans, you could have said that maybe that was a signpost that wasn't the way they were thinking, that maybe it was to do what they had been doing, but do it a little better. And I think it's a different pack if you've not just RJ Snyman, but Kilcoyne and maybe Jean Klein in there as well. Maybe you've some chance about muscling Leinster then. Without them, definitely becomes a lot more difficult. I still thought there were signs against Leinster the first day that some of the problems that have dogged them in the biggest games for the last few years were still there. I thought even for Andrew Conway's first try that they were still really narrow and almost found their way out to him for the score by default in the end, that there was opportunities to go wider, quicker. And I just think there's something in them that when they feel under pressure, their answer is to kind of go harder, tighten up, go harder, and not maybe to... There's still more work to be done just in terms of the options they take and the skill execution. And I hate even saying it, but intimidated probably isn't the right word, but I think they've lost so much to Leinster for the past number of years that it's really in their heads now. That, and I know Graham Rowntree was very bullish this week, but I wonder about their self-belief when it comes to the crucial moments against Leinster. I just think, what was the stat that they've lost on 15 of their last 16 visits to Dublin since going right back to 2009? I don't know. I mean, they need to get one over Leinster under their belt and see can they kick on from there. And look, maybe if Snayman had stayed on the pitch, maybe it would have been a different result the first day. I think he genuinely has the ability to be a transformative signing. But, yeah, I mean, it's going to take something we haven't seen, because everything they've done the last three semi-finals on the trot, they've lost. So,
and even in that match, Wes, there was some passages that encapsulated the difference that Munster would spend a lot of time, a lot of pressure, and come away with nothing. And especially when you're playing against Leinster, who do the exact opposite.
They just have to work harder for their scores to be forward about it.
And it just stands out more against Leinster, who get into that zone and very rarely come out with no points.
Teams tomorrow, Mick, is it? Do we teams for Leinster, Munster tomorrow? Will they be named tomorrow?
Thursday should be the day before, yeah.
Yeah, I think Leinster pretty much have a clean bit of health. I'm hearing James Ryan, by the way, is due back any minute now, like 3 days after having a shoulder operation. I mean,
the first bulletin said it was a 12-week, but we're not sure whether that was from... That must obviously have been from when he suffered the injury, which was when they were training just back, you know. So yeah. I think maybe the bulletin... or it was after the surgery as well, so it would have been counting the 12 weeks from when he suffered it, and now he's way ahead of time.
So we'll see if he...
Dan Levy as well, even if he doesn't play Friday night, Stuart Lancaster said he will play very shortly, and he may even get on Friday.
I think it's the first time they've had all their... they potentially have all their back rows fit. So there you go. All you need is 6 months off rugby to get your entire back row squad fit. It's no problem, you know.
What's your gut thoughts then on Friday night, Bert? You're going to be there, obviously. Do you give Munster much of a chance here? Obviously they do, but, like, you know, in terms of what we've seen from Leinster, where do you think Munster can win this game?
Look, the scary thing for Munster is, okay, they were very close to beating Leinster the first day, but Leinster's line-out, you know, wasn't great the first half. Leinster were very poor under the high ball, and Munster did a job on Leinster in the breakdown. You know, there's three real strong areas of possession for Munster, and they still couldn't beat Leinster. So that's obviously not a good sign. Having said that, I mean... you know, to lose Snyman, to end up with a centre play in the back row, to end up with your third choice prop, Lucet having to play 70 minutes. There's a lot of reasons why, you know, they weren't as clinical as they needed to be. And I think they actually looked better against Connacht. I know Connacht were poor, and the discipline in the game was kind of hard to understand, or their lack of discipline was hard to understand, and played a big role in the game. But I think Munster got a lot out of it. I just think backing up, getting a good win. And I agree with Wesley. I think kind of like a striker out of form, they kind of just need one to go in off their backside and just get a win by any manner of means, and that will do them the world of good. I don't think they're a million miles behind Leinster. And I think this is Leinster's final. You know, I think Leinster will go very strong this week and potentially then make a few changes next week for a final if they're lucky enough to get through it. I think they got to go back to the air again. I think they got to keep kicking contestables, and, you know, if Larmour plays fullback or whoever plays in the back three for Leinster, make it really uncomfortable for them. I think if you kick long or kick it off against Leinster, you know, you're not going to see the ball again for a while, and you find yourself back in one of the corners, you know, trying to exit yourself. And I also think, and I know that that's probably got Munster in trouble against Saracens, you know, in a couple of semi-finals, but I do think the kick chase, breakdown, making a mess, until...
Even more of a mess at the breakdown, yeah? Is that possible?
Well, if you look at what they can pick, if they can pick Tyburn, Clote, CJ Stander, Peter Manny, they have four world-class jacklers in that forward pack. And even if Leinster would be better at the breakdown and they know what's coming, I mean, it doesn't matter. The laws now do favour the jackler more so than the attacking side. And when you've got four world-class practitioners as they have, I mean, that has to be an area of strength. So I would say...
Why do you think CJ has excelled so much in the first two games at the breakdown, Birch? When, like, for example, we'd maybe identify Peter O'Mahony more with his jackal thread over the years, yet it hasn't borne out that way. Is it just adapting to the new rules better, or is it... Are players working in tandem now because that relationship between the tackler and the jackler and the tackle assist needs to be so clear?
Yeah, it does. It needs to be really clear. And I think Peter still has that in his game. It's just over the course of the Leinster game, there wasn't opportunities for him. It's just the way it fell. But, you know, I would say if Peter Manny gets 10 opportunities, he'll get in and slow the ball down 5 times, and you know, he might get 2 penalties and he get blown away the other 3. And Stander at the moment is kind of in that area. His ability to see an opportunity and to get in really quickly and be effective is, in fairness, he deserves massive credit for that, because that wasn't, you know, you saw him as a young player, you saw him in his early stage with Munster. It was about explosive power, and the carry was his thing. And he's actually become a good lineup option. And he's become, you know, his work rate's gone through the roof, but his explosive carry has probably gone down a little bit, but his actual technique as a back row and his ability to read opportunities has improved. Clote's built for it. Tyburn's not built for it, but he's been brilliant at it for 2 or 3 years. And I think, you know, if Munster are to play to their strengths, they have to have a big focus on that. And as I said, it doesn't matter if Leinster are gone better at it, and a breakdown is clearer. If you've got 4 threats in your forward pack, I think you're going to win 2 or 3 turnovers. And what they need to be able to do is be able to, I suppose, get some dominance in their maul. And not saying they have to score off maul, but they've got to be able to play off maul effectively. And yeah, and bring Conway and bring Earls off the wing a little bit more, and use them and try and get mismatches against Leinster front 5 players. So I think they have a chance. I do think they have a chance. And I think the 5-day turnaround won't be a big effect on them. And yeah, it's do or die for Munster.
The difference is in Stander's game now. I mean, what you've just described, I mean, he really is, he's kind of morphed into a better 6 now than he is an 8. Is that where I think Andy Farrell would look at him at, do you think?
Yeah, I think he's a very good 6. He's a good 8. I think, when I think back to when he played in the Bulls and when he came to Munster first, when he was having these like massive athletic carries, his work rate was way less, you know. So he's nearly wearing himself out by hitting rooks, by making tackles, by running so much, and that's why. Like, Kutsia is a little bit different. Kutsia's job is to carry for Ulster, and in some ways, it's a weakness for them, because you know, if you look at what Will Connors did to Kutsia the other night, you can actually nearly man mark Kutsia, whereas CJ carries a lot of times when it's slow ball and he sacrifices himself, whereas someone like Kutsia has the license to pick and choose his moments.
It's still Birch, as good as that is for CJ and the amount of work he's put in, that still leaves Munster or Ireland down a carrier.
No, 100%. And I think that's the problem. That's why they were so reliant on Snyman and Killer, and still will miss them massively, because I thought when they went off for Munster against Leinster, you know, you had a pack, you know, I think it was Archer, Lockman, Scannell, Billy Holland. I'm not sure who. Klein came on, but Klein's more. He is powerful, but he's more destructive without the ball. Yeah, Tommy O'Donnell, CJ, and Peter. And I just thought that pack's not going to be great in terms of a ball carrying point of view. And that is an issue for Ireland. It is an issue for Ireland. That's why someone like Doris you know, came into the picture last year because he is, you know, he's not a Marcel Cotier, but he wins collisions and he gets you go forward.
Okay. We'll just talk about the Heineken Cup. I mean, look, in terms of the fixture list, Mick, it's fairly full on when you think about it over the next few weeks. We're going, obviously, from the Pro 14 semi-finals, Champions Cup, obviously, is to finish out straight into the November window. Hearing today, or in the last couple of days, that Bernard Laporte now says that South Africa, they're in advanced negotiations to replace Japan. So if that were to work out, that'll be quite something. But that window in November is going to be obviously chock-a-block, the final on December the 5th, straight back into the new season. So it's coming thick and fast. But there is a new format for the Champions Cup, and it's good news for Connacht, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, because if it had have gone like last year, and if the Pro 14 was still providing seven teams, they may have ended up in a playoff, which was what happened last year for the seventh place. But because it's just straight eight, it was the top four from each province, so from each conference, minus the South African side, the Cheetahs. So the European Professional Club Rugby actually sent out the email on Monday because they knew everyone would need 48 hours to write up the copy of how it worked out.
Well, it took you 48 hours. Apparently the lads had it done after an hour, but it took you 2 days to get it up.
Well. No. Actually, yeah, we were talking to the guy and we had a good laugh when I said I was through it, but there's pools and there's tiers, but actually they missed the trick by just simplifying it when explaining it into groups. So let's just say take one Irish province and say who they'll be playing. Most likely Leinster will be one of the top seeds, the tier one teams. They're just going to play one English team and one French team home and away in the pool stages.
Right.
So that's just simply four group games.
Right. Took you 2 days to write that, didn't it?
So that's what I distilled it down to. And again, it's the same for, say, Connacht are definitely going to be a tier four team.
Okay.
They will play one of the tier one English teams and one of the tier one French teams.
Okay.
So it's, and then in the two pools of 12, the top four go into the quarterfinal, which is going to be played on a home and away basis. So it's two-legged quarterfinal and one-off games for the semi-final and the final.
Okay, all right. I mean, it's news. I think it will. I'm only messing with you. I was looking at it. I couldn't make head nor tail of it when I was reading it for the first time. I had to read it about four times and it still wasn't 100%. I thought it was interesting that if Leinster lose on Friday night, they become a tier two team, despite the fact they went through unbeaten and scored the most points.
Not automatically. So that's the caveat. So the Pro 14 confirmed to me that their finalists will be the tier one teams, except if somebody wins it outright. So if Leinster lose on Friday but win the Champions Cup, they will take a tier one spot. The same with Ulster. If they lose on Saturday but went on to win it, they would take the tier one spot, which would be the beaten finalist.
Yeah.
So is that clear?
Yes, it is. It's as clear as we're going to make it out. I mean, look, it's Birch, like, you know, it's more teams competing. You know, I think we're just mad to get rugby back into kind of some sort of full state with crowds as well. And hopefully by the time the Champions Cup comes around, the new season kicks off, we will have crowds back. I mean, it has to happen.
Yeah, that's the hope. I just on the European Cup, it sounds simple, tier one against tier four. And obviously, you know, from an Irish point of view, Leinster are the ones in tier, look like they're going to be in tier one at the moment. Just in tier four, Toulouse are in tier four at the moment and will stay in tier four unless they win the Champions Cup. So, you know, Montpellier for sure, but they probably haven't really done it. They've a very good squad, but they haven't really done it in Europe. But I think to draw Toulouse at tier four would be a disaster. But anyway, yeah, it's changed up. It's not very easy to understand. We won't care once we see who our teams are playing, and you know, it'll be another something else to look forward to. But I think talking about Pro 14 fixtures are Pro 12 are starting in October, and we don't know what format that's got either.
No, we know the South African side obviously can't compete, despite the fact that the South African national side will be here in November, but the South African test sides can't travel. It's all a bit of a mess. But yeah, I don't think and again, like, we don't want to be too hard on the Pro 12 as it will be here, but look, I guess this is, you know, the expansion always kind of raised a few eyebrows. There's now talk that obviously the Southern Kings are gone now as a franchise. You know, who's going to replace them? Will there be any South African sides left in? Are they going to bring in more South African sides? Nobody seems to know, which doesn't help the sponsors. It doesn't help the competition in terms of, you know, appeal to fans and trying to market it. It's a bit of a mess at the moment, and hopefully it's one they can sort out fairly quickly.
Yeah, I think they need to, obviously we know there's going to be a little bit of chaos now with the Kings and Cheetahs probably leaving. It looks like there's going to be four South African teams coming. And there's a rumour they'll start in January, so everyone else will start in October. And they'll come in January and they'll find some way of making it work out, which, again, won't be easy to understand. But whatever happens, I think we'll all give them a freebie for this year.
Yeah.
Or we'll be tolerant this year. But from next September, you know, we need a competition that makes sense and it's going to be viable, I think, on a long-term basis.
That's the key. Viable on a long-term basis, which
if you had the four South African Super Rugby teams, yeah, though, in the long run, that adds massively to the attractiveness of the competition. Springboks are playing, you know. So I mean, I don't know what New Zealand are at thinking they can go it alone. I mean, the All Blacks will start charging $3 million in appearance fee for their international matches, maybe. But
Australia are nice as well. Australia are an absolute mess as well. So nobody going to games and the crowds are way down. Like, rugby's all over the place there.
Well, even with the whole, like, glory of fans being in the ground in New Zealand, like, that, you know, they're coming back from COVID and all the rest of it when the competition was just going on, they still weren't even selling out stadiums there. So I don't know how they think just playing domestic competition is going to work for them long term, but they do seem to think that. It's curious. I think with the Champions Cup one, I think not knowing who you're playing, fans not being able to work it out, and then league tables being decided amongst teams that have effectively had nothing to do with each other because they haven't played each other. I think it's just another layer. I mean, we can't give out too much this year. We have to give them a freebie, as Bert said, but I think it'll be another thing that contributes to fans being less engaged with that tournament. You know, we've seen over the last 10 years that engagement fall and fall and fall compared to that glory run from like 2000 to 2012 kind of a thing. And I hope it recovers, really. But even two-legged quarterfinals is, I mean, it's interesting, but it's a big move, you know?
Yeah, it is.
It's just for this year only as well, because they needed to just decide how they were going to do it, with top 14 being cancelled and the pro 14 being curtailed.
That's fair enough, Michael, but I do think the competition is falling. It's slipping in terms of public interest, in terms of some of the clubs buy into it. So again, while this is just for this year, you know, there has to be something done to make it back. I tried to get it back towards where it was in the calendar and in rugby fans' mind. I think it has. I agree with Wesley. I think since they changed the organization management and obviously chased cash through different pay-per-view, etc., I just think it's definitely not as attractive as it was for players or coaches or fans.
Yeah, listen, what we all want to see is CBC, you know, coming in, organizing the English 18s from England, the four Irish provinces, maybe two from Wales, one from Scotland. Let's get the Anglo-Celtic League up and running, sell it to Sky or BT, whoever you want, and that's going to be the highlight centrepiece basically for the season coming on. We all know that's what they're going to do. That's what they're pushing for. It's not a when, it's not if, it's when. So, you know, I mean, the sooner that happens, the better, because, like, you know, as you say, the Champions Cup has lost its appeal. England, they're struggling financially as well, the Premiership.
Everyone has a problem with, like, people selling their soul to CBC and all that, which, like, I can agree with to a point, but I don't know if that influencing the running of the game is any less palatable than the situation where the English and French clubs kind of signaled their lack of interest in European competition. And that's what's had the massive knock-on effect, that if you know your opponents aren't that interested in even competing, not to mind winning or losing, well, where's the big draw in winning it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay, look, lads, we're going to wrap it up because we're just time for this week. Enjoy the matches this weekend. Bert, you're on television duty with Premier Sport. We'll all be watching as well, and we're going to talk about the games and all things rugby on the podcast next week. Thanks for joining us. We're back now. I promise we'll be here every single week. Good luck.